Welcome to In Plain Legal. I'm DNA High Easton, and today we're making the law something everyone can understand. You're watching Now Media Television. Welcome to In Plain Legal, the show where we take intimidating legal and tax topics and break them down into clear, practical conversations you can actually understand. I'm your host, DNA High Easton, and our goal is simple: to replace fear and confusion with clarity and confidence. Today's guest is John Mitchell, a Houston-based tax attorney with more than 30 years of experience in tax preparation and IRS controversy. John is a former IRS appeals officer, has prepared over 10,000 tax returns, and has handled more than $100 million in IRS disputes, including examinations, collections, appeals, and tax court litigation. He's also one of only 10 individuals nationwide to pass the U.S. Tax Court Admission Exam in 2024, a best-selling author, national speaker, and host of the Tax Pro podcast. John is widely known for making complex tax issues understandable, and that's exactly why he's here today. John, welcome to In Plain Legal. We're so glad to have you.
Oh my goodness, man. I am pleased. I'm ecstatic. I'm overjoyed. I'm overflowing with joy to be here with you today. Oh my goodness. I am just so excited, and I'm happy and excited to bring some good information to your audience today.
Me too. Oh my goodness. I'm so happy you're here. So we're starting with a moment almost everyone dreads: opening the mailbox and seeing a letter from the IRS. Before anyone even reads it, fear sets in. Today, we're slowing that moment down and talking about what those letters actually mean and how to respond with clarity instead of panic. So for most people, or many people and business owners, as IRS letter triggers immediate fear, it feels like trouble, guilt, or punishment, even when nothing wrong has been done. Understanding why letters are sent and what they're really saying can dramatically reduce stress and prevent costly mistakes. John, let's talk about it. Why do IRS letters feel so scary, even when someone hasn't done anything wrong?
Well, you know, that's a great question. And one of the things that I've found over the years is that, it's been said, and it wasn't said by me, it was said by people much, smarter and more well-seasoned than I am, but it's said that fear stands for false evidence appearing real. And that's a good thing to keep in mind, because while it is very serious, very important for you to keep your taxes, up to date, be in compliance and all that good stuff, a lot of times people get a letter from the IRS and they're scared. And the reason why they're scared, one of the biggest reasons why, can be they just don't know what's going to, what it's about, right? Like, what is this letter? What can happen to me? I've had people say, oh my God, they're going to take my house, or something like that. And so fear is a big thing. And the fear a lot of times grows out of just not knowing, what's going on and what to do about it. And that's where, seasoned professionals like me can step up and kind of help hold your hand and guide you through and let you know that everything's going to be all right.
Well, I'm really happy that we have people like you to help ease that concern, right? It's just the first step of having the conversation. So along those same lines, what are the most common reasons the IRS sends letters to everyday people or small business owners?
Let me tell you this. I read a statistic, and I don't know the exact percentage because it's been a while, but I do know that a very large percentage, of the letters that the IRS sends out are what are known as CP2000 letters. And those are just some kind of error in calculation, something that doesn't add up on the tax return. And though I've seen those be for as little as, $20, $25. So sometimes what will happen is people get a letter from the IRS. And let me tell you this, I have seen the day where they walk into my office, they got a stack of letters this big from the IRS, and they're all unopened. And so, you can't use the ostrich, the ostrich method and keep your head buried in the sand and expect that it's just going to go away. Now, that's not 100% impossible. Sometimes, if you ignore the problem, it will go away because they'll just make adjustments on the back end and it'll be all good. But that's not advisable. The advisable thing is open your mail from the IRS, read it, and try your best to understand it. If you don't understand it, there's all kinds of tools you can use. Go to the IRS.gov website. Believe you me, if you go and input every letter from the IRS, usually in the upper left or up, upper right or lower right-hand side, the letter will have a serial number. And one of the most common letters that's sent, the big percentage of letters are CP2000s. But if you go to the IRS website and type in the search bar the serial number of that letter, every letter, it'll have a plain language explanation of it, and you'll be able to kind of get an idea what's going on. Maybe not an idea how to fix it exactly, but you'll at least have a better grasp of what's going on. So knowledge, is knowledge is power, and knowledge will help you overcome that fear. So that's the very first thing I would tell people.
Thank you so much for saying that, because I do know that a lot of people, IRS is just like this, oh, we don't want to touch it, we don't want to look at it, we don't want to know anything about it, even though we know that the only thing that's real and constant in this world is death and taxes, right? So estate planning attorney over here and tax attorney over there. So we understand the importance of having the knowledge, having the education to be able to get through it. So the fact that you are able to help subside a lot of our viewers' fears today is phenomenal. And I just want to say thank you for that.
Yes, ma'am. Now, that old saw about death and taxes, but I recently heard a new take on that, and they said death, at least you only have to face it once.
That's so true. That's so true. And I'm glad that there are professionals like you and I that are here to help guide our clients and prospective viewers on what is important to know so that they can be able to navigate through it. So, how can someone tell the difference between a simple notice and a more serious issue?
All right, I'm going to give everybody out there a rule of thumb,
Okay.
okay? And it's just that. It's a rule of thumb. It's not 100%, but it'll get you pretty far down the road, right? If you remember this. Now, I did just say whatever mail you get from the IRS, open it up, look at it, don't lose it. Open it up, look at it, try and figure out what it's about. All right, so you can kind of get a heads up and get I guess what would you say, an idea how you want to pursue it, how you want to go about fixing whatever problem is up, right? But the big rule of thumb is how do you know what letters are important and what letters are not as important, a little bit less important? Anything that comes to you from the IRS by certified mail, if you had to sign for it, or if you look at the envelope and there's that green certified sticker on it, that is going to be top of your list, red alert, time to do something about it, right? Because usually those are the cases when the IRS sends you something and it came by certified mail. That means that they are now documenting when that letter was had arrived with you. And a lot of times, as you know, there's going to be rights attached to that, right? And the clock is ticking, right? Tick tock, tick tock. That means you certified mail means they're counting down the days, and that means it's time to really, really, really sit up and pay attention more so than before.
That is a really great rule of thumb, especially for general ideas, right? And I'm assuming even with a certified letter, it doesn't matter if it's $20 versus $200,000. I mean, it just as long as it's potentially certified, the IRS wants to know that it got to that person, right?
Yes, ma'am, that's right. So certified mail is the big tip off that you better be paying attention and doing something about it.
Well, thank you for that. So, I mean, we kind of touched a little bit about this earlier, but I kind of want to delve just a little bit deeper into this. What mistakes do people make when they ignore the letter or respond too quickly out of fear?
Well, one thing that I've seen, and again, I'll tell you this, I've seen this over my 30 years. I've seen it probably 100 times. People walk into my office, they've got a big, big Kroger bag, a grocery bag full of envelopes from the IRS, And of course, I used to have a CPA friend. He said, yeah, he says, you got to dump the bag out on your conference table and, push the dead bugs across to one side of the table and the correspondence to the other side of the table, right? And again, one of the biggest things I've seen, they come in, they got all these letters from the IRS, and they're all unopened, right? And many times I've opened the letters right in front of them, and I say, oh my God, Jesus, if I had it, if I had seen this 2 weeks ago, there would be more avenues that we could pursue to do something about this, right? And so one of the big things is the big mistakes that I see people make is to just not open the mail at all and not even try to figure out what it's about. On the other end of the spectrum, I've seen people that let's say an appeal comes and then it comes with some no I'm sorry, a letter comes and it comes with some appeal rights, right? And so then the people write up on their own an appeal. And maybe the appeal is just quite like imagine a bridge that doesn't quite reach the other side, right? So sometimes there is, people get in a hurry and they answer these letters, and the answer is either not what the IRS was looking for or it's just not complete. I have a case on my desk right now where the IRS had sent this guy a letter. And he had answered the letter, but he didn't put the complete documentation that the IRS would have needed to close the case out, right? And so now he's had to come and hire me to go back because the IRS made an adverse determination. Because as you know, if the IRS or any government agency sends you a letter asking for more documentation, the burden of proof is on you to prove whatever deductions or whatever you're going to show on your tax return to show the accuracy of that, right? And so if you don't meet that burden of proof, they're doing an examination, then the hammer can drop, right? Like they can make a determination that's not, that's adverse to you. They can make a determination that you don't want. And so it's important to make sure when you're answering the IRS also that you answer completely and you answer in a way that's actually going to help you settle your matter with them and not something that's going to, prolong and take things. Because now the guy that I'm telling you about, he has now come into my office and now he's paying, thousands of dollars. And now he's brought me the rest of the information that he could have provided to the IRS in the first place. Or even if he had come in and hired me, and that's another thing. People out there, don't be afraid, or sometimes there's a saying that the way you try and cut corners and it comes out, instead of cheaper, it comes out more expensive for you. So it's a good idea to get somebody involved. It doesn't have to be me, but me or somebody like me that deals with the IRS all the time, and we're gonna kind of be better equipped. Because we do it every day. I give the example, and I'm sorry to ramble on, but I give the example and I say, hey, I could, if I wanted to, right? Like, I know the proper steps to go outside right now and change the oil in my car, right? Don't want to, but I could do it, right? Or I can change a flat tire, right? But I cannot rebuild my engine, right? That I don't have the skill set for that. Don't have the practice, never done it before. And I'm 100% sure if I go rebuild my engine when I'm done, or I think I'm done, there's going to be parts left over, right? I mean, where the hell does this screw go, right?
That makes
So
sense. So
it's
you're
not going to be
basically
right.
saying that at the end of the day, you are the person that people need to contact. They need to be aware of the situation. They need to not panic and make sure that they open up their mail. Well, coming up, we'll talk about how people will fall behind on taxes often without realizing it and why it feels so hard to get out once it starts. Stay with us. We'll be right back with clear explanations, practical advice, and the legal insights you need without the jargon. This is In Plain Legal on Now Media Television. And we're back. I'm DNA High Easton, and you're watching In Plain Legal on Now Media Television. Let's continue breaking down the law together. Welcome back to In Plain Legal. Want more of what you're watching? Stay connected to In Plain Legal and every Now Media TV favorite live or on demand anytime you like. Download the free Now Media TV app on Roku or iOS and unlock nonstop bilingual programming in English and Spanish. On the move, You can also catch the podcast version right from our website at www.nowmedia.tv. From business and news to lifestyle, culture, and beyond, Now Media TV is streaming around the clock, ready whenever you are. Welcome back to In Plain Legal. I'm DNA High Easton, and we're continuing our conversation with tax attorney John Mitchell. In this segment, we're talking about what happens when taxes quietly fall behind and why it often feels overwhelming before people even understand how it started. Tax problems usually don't happen overnight. They build slowly through misunderstandings, misfilings, cash flow issues, or fear-based avoidance. Over time, stress and shame take over, making it harder for people to ask for help or take action. John, let's talk about it. How do people usually fall behind on taxes without realizing it at first?
Man, oh man, I've got lots of war stories I could tell you about that. A lot of times what happens, one of the main things that I've seen over the years, a lot of times is something will happen in people's lives, right? Like they're rolling along, everything's fine, they're in compliance, they're, you know, filling out their tax forms, they're sending in their payments, everything's good, and then something happens, right? They either get, they get sick, or maybe they're sick, or maybe a kid or an elderly parent, some life event happens, and they fall behind, right? And then once they fall behind, they start getting IRS notices, bury their head in the sand, and then they start, kind of ignore it. Maybe it'll go away, but it doesn't. And those penalties and interest just starts adding up and adding up. And, whereas if we had gotten with the IRS early on and we can establish some kind of hardship, some kind of payment plan or something, then, you know, we could get an easier, more favorable outcome. But the thing just snowballs because they left it alone. And now you've got maybe your original tax liability that was due, and now you've got a bunch of penalties and interest that have stacked on top of that. And, you know, I've seen it be where people owe them twice or more than twice as much, you know. So a lot of times it's a just some kind of life event that takes place. Now I've also seen other things take place, like unfortunately I had a client down in the Rio Grande Valley whose husband ran a business, and he just for years and years, and I believe you me, this did go on for years, he was not paying or not properly paying the company's payroll taxes. Unfortunately, he passed away, and when he passed away and she went into the business to start figuring out what's going on with the business, she found stacks and stacks of IRS notices. And, that is the way her husband has already passed away. She's grieving. She's struggling to get through that. And now you got a bunch of IRS problems on top of it that she had not been told about at all and did not know about. So, sometimes things, I saw another case, this happened, right? There was a guy, he worked in a construction company, but he was doing jobs on the side, and his wife did not know this. And so he built up a bunch of tax liabilities and then just skipped town and disappeared and, left her to fend off the IRS and just deal with trying to get a divorce and whatever else she was dealing with. So I've seen that happen. So, but a lot of times it's just some kind of life event that happened, and it just snowballs from there. And so it's very important to, get with the IRS or get with a professional that can help you get with the IRS. And a lot of times things can be handled in a way that will cause much less of an impact on you, will help you get your hands on it before it gets out of hand.
You know what? Thank you for saying all that, because I have to say, I practice in estate planning and probate and guardianship. And when taxes are not resolved during someone's lifetime, it can lead to so many problems and issues for the personal representative to try and fix when someone has passed away. So the biggest thing here is fear, right? It's overcoming the fear of what this is even going to look like. And to be grieving while you're trying to fix tax issues is like the worst thing to do for someone that is on the other end of dealing with that grief. So you talked a lot about business owners, so I kind of want to delve into that a little bit deeper. Why do tax problems feel so personal and overwhelming for business owners specifically?
You know, when you are a business owner, and I say this, because I have been in and out of business pretty much my entire adult life. And when you're a business owner, your entire identity is wrapped up in that business, right? If that business fails, you take it personally. If that business fails, that is in a lot of people's mind, right? That is a black mark on them that just sticks around basically forever, right? And so that's a big psychological thing. And not only that, keep in mind, if you're a business owner, right? You got employees probably, you got suppliers, you got people that are dependent on you. And so having a tax problem, a lot of times I've seen the day, for example, I had a few 3 or 4 years ago, I had a client walk in and he told me, John, you have got to win on this IRS issue, because if you don't win, this is going to be the end of my business. I'm going to have to declare bankruptcy. I'm going to have to liquidate. I'm not going to be able to go on if you don't win this tax argument that we're having, right? And it's just all wrapped up to people in their identity. And so that is that's kind of a thing that's a very touchy thing for people. And I get it. Believe you me, I understand it.
That makes a lot of sense. And just briefly, what do you wish people knew earlier that could have helped them avoid years of stress?
You know, one of the things is, like I said, don't bury your head in the sand. Kind of know what can jump up and bite you, and take steps to make sure that it doesn't. And I'll tell you this, it's way cheaper to hire a professional. Like I said, be it me or be it anyone else you want, somebody besides me, right? But it doesn't have to be me, but hire me or somebody like me that can help you out. It is much cheaper to hire a professional to help keep you out of trouble than to hire the professional once you're already in trouble and trying to fix problems. That's way more expensive.
That makes sense. So, John, for people who want to learn more or get reliable tax guidance, where can they find you or follow your work?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm happy to chat with people. My website is the main way you could probably get in touch with me. So it's www dash no www.99-taxhelp.com, and there is you'll see all kind of information, and you'll see my bio and my pretty headshot, and you can click on the link and email me through the website. So that that's one main way. Also, my telephone number, 1-800-99-TAX-HELP. So if you just spell out tax help on your telephone keyboard, but in case you don't want to do that, it's 1-800-998-2943. And that gets you through to our office. One final way I can mention attorney John Mitchell at no, I'm sorry. Let me change that. Attorney Mitchell at pm.me. I'm using that one now. So you can email me, and that's a good way to get a hold of me.
Well, thank you so much for sharing all that information. I'm sure our viewers are going to be flooding your phone and your email box. Up next,
Yes, ma'am.
we'll talk about a common habit that causes serious legal and tax confusion, mixing personal and business money. Stay with us. We'll be right back with clear explanations, practical advice, and the legal insights you need without the jargon. This is In Plain Legal on Now Media Television. And we're back. I'm DNA High Easton, and you're watching In Plain Legal on Now Media Television. Let's continue breaking down the law together. Welcome back to In Plain Legal. Now, many business owners don't realize they're creating risk until something goes wrong. In this segment, we're breaking down one of the most common and avoidable sources of confusion. When personal and business finances are mixed, clarity disappears. This can lead to tax issues, audit complications, and loss of legal protections. Small habits that feel harmless early on often create major consequences later. John, you know the deal. Why do so many small business owners mix personal and business money without realizing the risk?
Yes, ma'am. Oh my goodness. Yeah, you are sure right. I've seen that many, many times. And you know what happens? It's part of it, I think, is just a lack of knowledge, lack of understanding on the part of people who just don't kind of realize how bad that can be, right? I know you are familiar, and probably a few people out there in the audience have heard of the concept of piercing the corporate veil, right? And so if you have an entity like an LLC or a corp, that can be an issue, and not only just civilly, but also in tax. And so some of those tax benefits that you have been working so hard to achieve, those will be lost because if the IRS determines that things are so commingled that you don't really have a separate entity at all, then you can run into that kind of trouble. They may try to just consolidate everything on a 1040 form, and that can end up costing you a lot of money. And so, but a lot of people just don't know or don't realize how that can, how easily that can come about. I tell people all the time, the best way that you can go about it, and especially if you've got a corporation or an LLC, your best bet is to have separate personal and business bank accounts, personal and business credit cards, et cetera, right? And don't mix the two up is the very best way. And if your business is producing money, which knock, knock, knock on wood, it should be, right? Like that's why you're in business. If your business is producing earnings for you, well, you should transfer those earnings in some form or fashion to your personal bank account and spend your personal money as you normally would as personal expenses. And because then when you have, it's so many complications when you're living out of one bank account. For on the one hand, that really raises a kind of in the auditor's mind at the IRS, they're thinking they are really going to be looking closely at your expenses. Are they, these things that are run through the business account, are these real business expenses? Because if they're not, it just wants to make them dig deeper and dig deeper and find out which expenses are actually business expenses. And that, it not only can be more expensive for you as a business owner, if you hire a bookkeeper, your bookkeeper is going to be more expensive because they got to dig through and separate out personal versus business expenses. If you get audited and you have to hire me to represent you during the audit, it's going to be more expensive because the IRS is going to dig deeper and it's going to take longer. And not only does IRS have to dig through a bunch of personal stuff to get to your business expenses, then I've got to do it, right? And so it's just more trouble and more effort, more expense all the way around if if you're mixing business and personal. I had a lady, a hairdresser, a couple, 3, 4 years ago also, and she had not a corporation. She had just a DBA, right? Now, us attorney types will say, well, the difference between a DBA and having an entity is when you're dealing with a DBA, there's no legal distinction between you and your business, right? You are your business. But even so, I had her go to Bank of America. That's where her personal account was. I said, open up another account. It doesn't even have to be a business account. So we got BOA to open her up another checking account, a free checking account. And that way, but see, now you got two accounts. And no matter what the bank is calling that account, this other account, this secondary account, this is now your business account. This is where you're going to receive your cash deposits, your Venmos, your PayPal stuff from all those hair appointments you did, all that, your Square, your little, little credit card terminal, all that's going to go into this other account. Whether the bank is calling a business account or not, that's between you and the bank. But for the IRS purposes, that's now your business account. So now, if an audit should come about, I can now show lay out all these bank statements and show the IRS and say these are all business transactions. And I said, look, just transfer money from the business account, quote unquote, right? The one that you're calling a business account, transfer that to your personal account and keep those expenses separate. I said, don't pay your rent, don't pay your light bill, don't pay stuff, personal expenses out of your business account and vice versa, right? Keep it separate, and that's going to be much better for you, especially knock on wood if you should get audited.
That makes a lot of sense. So let's just play this out, right, with this client that you just discussed. You had had her put a, make a separate account for her, DBA business, right? And let's say that she ended up taking some money and not actually transferring it into a personal account, but she took some money from her business account and paid something that was of hers. Would you consider that to be an owner distribution, or at least a way to kind of characterize it so that way, for tax purposes, they can show kind of a fine line for that? Or can you explain that a little bit to the audience, what I mean by that?
Right. Well, that is what I would categorize that as. I mean, let's say, all right, you got you. Let's use this lady as an example. All right, she's got her quote unquote business account, right? Just as her secondary checking account that she's running all the business transactions through that. And let's say one day she accidentally grabbed the wrong debit card and went grocery shopping for that. Well, in her books and records, her business's books and records, I would then just call that a distribution and call it a day, right? So that's the effect that it would have, because that is not going to be a deductible business expense that you had. That's a personal expense. So yeah, I would definitely, in that case, I would call that an owner's distribution, right? And you just want to, I understand life happens, right? Heck, I have even, now don't tell the IRS this, I've even been known to swipe my business debit card, a couple of times a year here and there for something that might be personal. And so, but then when we go back and do the books, we gotta categorize that correctly, right? But yeah, you want to keep that kind of stuff down to a minimum.
That makes sense. So, what misunderstandings do business owners have about protection when finances aren't clearly really separated?
Well, that goes back to what we talked about in the very, very first part of the segment, right? Piercing the corporate veil. Let's say you've got you're well off, right? And you got your law practice and you got your five rental properties and they're all in LLCs and you got your bank accounts all set up. And the minute that you start commingling funds, and the day that somebody comes after you because some joker tripped and fell down in your front yard of your rental property, and now you're going to have some other lawyer type on the other side of the table saying, hey, pierce the corporate veil, right? Let's go after everything, right? And you can find your protection being greatly reduced, or at least in danger of, because you've commingled. The argument's going to be made. Judge, this is not a true and separate entity. Everything's commingled with the owners. There's no distinction. It's not being run in a business-like manner. I'll tell you another way this can come back and bite you in the rear end, is Code Section 183. That's the hobby loss. And so if you have a business and you're calling it a business and you've got losses 1 year, losses another year, losses another year, they're going to come back and say, hey, is that really a business? And one of the ways that the courts have determined, how do you determine what's a business and what's not? Because if it's a hobby, all those hobby expenses are not going to be allowed, right? And so that you're not going to be able to offset your ordinary income with it, all kinds of things. So one of the main ways that they look at that is they look at it through a lens of, did you operate your business as a business? And part of that is keeping separate books and records.
That makes sense. So I'm assuming, based on what you've been discussing with me today, that clarity and education around money can reduce stress and improve decision making. Is that correct?
That is correct. I've said many times, if you have to spend a couple of $100 to come in and buy an hour of my time to sit in my conference room and show me the paperwork and go walk through things, that might be a couple of $100 well spent for you. Because if I can help you avoid a problem in the first place, like I said before, much cheaper to avoid the problem than to have the problem and then try and fix the problem.
Well, you heard it here, folks. We have to be proactive when it comes to making sure that our businesses are protected, right? And that we're paying the proper taxes when necessary. Coming up, we'll close with a conversation about protection and why many people assume they're covered until they find out they're not. Stay with us. We'll be right back with clear explanations, practical advice, and the legal insights you need without the jargon. This is In Plain Legal on Now Media Television. And we're back. I'm DNA High Easton, and you're watching In Plain Legal on Now Media Television. Let's continue breaking down the law together. Welcome back to In Plain Legal. Don't miss a second of this show or any of your Now Media TV favorites, streaming live and on demand whenever and wherever you want. Grab the free Now Media TV app on Roku or iOS and enjoy instant access to our lineup of bilingual programs in both English and Spanish. Prefer podcasts? Listen to In Plain Legal anytime on the Now Media TV website at www.nowmedia.tv. Covering business, breaking news, lifestyle, culture, and more, Now Media TV is available 24/7, so the stories you care about are always within reach. Welcome back to In Plain Legal. As we close today's conversation, we're addressing a belief that causes serious trouble, the assumption that doing the basics means you're fully protected. Now, many people believe they're legally and financially protected without fully understanding liability, filings, or compliance requirements. These blind spots often surface only when there is an audit, dispute, or legal challenge, when clarity matters the most. John, why do people believe they're protected just because they did the basics?
You know, one of the things that I've seen, how I've seen this manifest itself, people start a business and then, you know, let's dive into just momentarily 1099 contract labor versus W-2 employees, right? Now, having employees that get paid with a W-2, you know, is a little bit more, a little bit more of a pain, right? It's a little bit more work, more trouble, more expense for the employer. And part of what I've seen happen, people will sit, they'll go to their friend or their neighbor, and their neighbor will say, "Hey, don't worry about it. Just pay them in cash under the table. You give them a 1099 at the end of the year. It's all good." And so part of it might be, and I'm not, you know, accusing anybody of anything, but part of it might be partly, "Hey, what you know." You hear and understand what's best and most convenient for you to hear and understand, right? And so, you know, then you'd start justifying it. You fill in the blanks in your mind and say, "Well, you know, Bob told me it was okay. I guess, you know, he's been in business for a few years. You know, Bob's in the plumbing business, right? And he told you, and you're in the roofing business, and oh, those are similar. So Bob, he's been in business a while. He knows what he's talking about. It must be perfectly fine for me to pay my secretary with a 1099 and not withhold any taxes or anything." And so part of it is, you know, whistling through the graveyard, right? Or you know, like a horse, like put those blinders on and just keep going forward and, you know, pretend nothing bad's going to happen, right? And so that can definitely be part of what happens.
That makes sense. So, what are the common blind spots that create legal or tax exposure later on?
Well, you know, the devil's in the details, as they say, right? And so you got to make sure, let's use another example. Like some people say, "Well, let's get an S corp, and that way we'll save on taxes," right? Well, when you endeavor to manage an S corp, one of the things, the requirements for that to be a valid election, you have to take reasonable compensation, right? Mm-hmm. And so people go along and, you know, they take distributions from their S corp. They're not paying federal income tax on it because it's a, you know, distribution. Or they're not paying, I'm sorry, Social Security and Medicare tax on it because it's a distribution, right? Mm-hmm. But the detail was that you had to have had reasonable compensation. You can't demonstrate that, and then it comes back and bites you in the form of the IRS is now going to do an audit when they do the audit, they're going to make determinations that are not in your favor, and that's going to end up costing you. And so those tax advantages that you thought you had are now gone. But why? Because you did not cross the T's and dot the I's properly. And so again, I hate to keep beating a dead horse. So sorry for all the horse lovers out there, but again, a little bit of money and effort up front to make sure that you're in compliance will go a long way toward not having you to spend more money and more time and more effort later on to fix problems that have cropped up.
Thank you for sharing that. So let me ask you this question. Is there a typical time that the IRS can come back and do an audit on somebody's taxes?
People kind of use loosely statute of limitations, and when we're talking about taxes, we have three categories of statutes of limitations. So there's what we call the ASED, the assessment statute end date, the CSED, collection statute end date, and the RSED, the refund statute end date. So what you're particularly asking about right now is the ASED. Now, the assessment statute, and let's go back and define, first of all, it's useful to think about what is an assessment. What is a tax assessment? When we talk about an assessment, all we're talking about in this context is the IRS has entered into their books and records an amount of money for a tax type and tax period. They call that, think about a spreadsheet, and you got your columns and you got your rows. And when those columns and rows cross at a certain point, that's called a cell, right? So if when in taxes we talk about a tax type, so you might have excise tax, you might have an employment tax, you might have an income tax, right? So there's a tax type, and then there is a tax period. So for 1040s, it's January through December, January 1st to December 31st, and that is a tax year. But if you're talking about a different kind of tax, let's say a 941, which is employment, then that's going to be a 3 month tax period, right? So where that tax type and that tax period connect, right? And within the IRS, they call that a module. And so each module can have its own assessment. And the assessment is just the IRS entering into their books and records the fact that you owe money for that tax type, for that tax period, right? And so each module has its own assessment, and it can have separate assessments for penalties and interest, et cetera, right? So when you are talking about an assessment, the IRS generally has 3 years from the end of the ta tax period to make an assessment. So if we're talking about a 1040 and we're talking about 2025, let's use last year as an example, right? So the IRS, so the tax period ended December 31st, and then the tax is due April 15th, and your IRS assessment statute is going to end 3 years from now. That's your general rule, is 3 years. Now, there is a 6 year assessment rule, so that it can be double the period of time. So the IRS might have 6 years to assess a tax on your account under certain circumstances, and that would be greater than $5,000 of foreign income or assets. So that another example of that would be 25% understatement of the tax liability. And that can include, depending on what circuit you're in, because the circuits, of course, have treated this differently. Why would they not, right? And so, depending on what circuit you're in, that also can include basis adjustments that have caused you to underpay your tax. So, if that's more than 25%, then that's negligence, and that raises your statute to 6 years. But it can also be an unlimited statute. So theoretically, they could come after me for that tax return I didn't file back in 1989. If they get some information today in 2026, that I owed money, they can legally go back that far. It's an unlimited statute in a couple of cases. That's when a fraudulent return has been filed or when no tax return was filed. So I'm gonna watch that.
You know, that is such valuable information because at the end of the day, we all need to be informed and not afraid about having these types of conversations so we can avoid any potential legal trouble down the line, right?
Right. And I tell people all the time when they come in and talk to me, look, we have what is known as a privileged communication here, which means if you tell me there's a body buried in your backyard, I literally cannot say anything about it to anybody, right? That's confidential, it's privileged. So if you're going to come to me and you're going to spend money to get my advice, it behooves you to tell me the complete and whole story. If you've been skimming money out of your business, maybe you might want to mention that so that I know, where the blind spot is and where we might get hit later on. So, word to the wise, be honest with your attorney.
Absolutely. That is the best advice that you can give anybody viewing our show. I'm going to say it again. You need to be honest with your attorney. John, this has been incredibly helpful. Where can people follow your work and continue learning from you?
Yes, ma'am. I am always happy to take a few minutes and chat with people about whatever's going on in their world. And so, people can reach out to me through my website. It's at 99-taxhelp.com, and also 1-800-99-TAXHELP or 1-800-998-2943. And that'll get you through to my office. Email attorneymitchell@pm.me. Also gets you through to me, and like I said, I'm happy to. I do not bite, and I'm happy to chat with people.
John, thank you for bringing so much clarity and calmness to topics that usually cause fear and confusion.
Yes, ma'am.
Today's conversation reminded us that legal and tax issues don't have to be overwhelming when we understand them. For everyone watching, the takeaway is simple. Information creates confidence. Ask questions early, get clarity, and don't let fear drive your decisions. I'm DNA High Easton, and this has been In Plain Legal. We'll see you next time.